One, two, three. This is Dr. Alex Avila, and this is Love University. I'm a psychologist, author, and speaker. Every week, we talk about how to love yourself, others, and a higher nature. We talk about love, relationships, self-esteem, basically how to be the best person you can be. And this summer, we're doing what I call the guest lecture series. We're bringing on great guests that have a lot of knowledge and wisdom to share with us on different topics. And today, I'm very excited because we're going to be talking about a mature topic, and this is for adult mature audiences, sexuality. And the person I have today is Jessa Zimmerman, who is a licensed mental health counselor, certified sex therapist from ASECT organization. And she does a lot of work with couples and sexuality and helping them have, you know, a rewarding sex lives and marriage lives. And one thing interesting, she actually refers to her work as grief and loss work, because when people suffer from a lack of sex life, it is like losing something. And she says that 20% of the time sex is important when it's going good, but 70% importance when it's going bad. So welcome, Jessa. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Perfect. Now, that's a very fascinating statistic. Tell us about that. 20% of importance when it's going good and 70% when sex is going bad. Why is that?
Yeah, and I can't cite the research study or anything, but basically it illustrates that when sex is working in your relationship, you know, it feels reasonably important, but not huge. But if it isn't working, it feels like 70 or 80% of the relationship, right? It just feels like everything's bad.
Definitely.
At least that's typically how people experience it.
I see. And you talk about grief and loss work. That's what struck me. You said you switched to getting your master's in this area because you wanted to help people with grief and loss. And how does that work? Why is sex related to grief and loss?
Well, I mean, this first came to my attention when I was getting my master's degree to be a therapist, and a sex therapist came in, and she was the one that said, you know, I think of most of my work as grief and loss work. And it was just something that hit me in the gut. I so resonated with that because I think people are really suffering if they're not connecting sexually with their partner. I mean, at least if they want to be, right? It really is a loss. And I've had clients say things to me like, I feel loneliest when I'm in bed next to my spouse. You know, I mean, it's heartbreaking stuff. So many people struggle with this, and lots of people are experiencing really profound sadness about it.
Definitely. And we're going to get into very interesting topics like the sexless marriage and sexual discrepancies among partners. But if you really think about it, people are kind of afraid to talk about sex. You know, things like, what can they say, money, sex, religion, and politics are a little bit tricky topics. But why are people so afraid to talk about sex in an open way?
Well, I mean, I think it's several different factors. I mean, one is that in our culture, sex is taboo, you know, like even getting the talk, if you got one from your parents, right, was a big deal. It's just not a common accepted conversation. It's, you know, it just doesn't happen, right?
Yes.
And then I think people are afraid to talk about sex when it isn't going well because they feel broken, right?
Yes.
It's such a fundamental part of our humanity. And if it isn't working, I think there's so much fear and sadness about it. It's really hard to address it because people aren't sure. They're not sure I can get better, right? So what's it going to expose if I bring it up?
Yeah, and I think later on in the talk today, we can talk about self-esteem and how some people tie it into sexuality. But what I want to get into, Justin, I thought this was really fascinating. On your website, you have a sex quiz. Now, you know, quizzes are very popular. I have one on my website, lovetype.com, on compatibility and love. So your quiz is very interesting because it seems like you break it down into different factors. For example, I think you talk about avoidance. One question is, do you avoid sex or do you go to bed at the same time? So tell us a little bit about the sexual avoidance pattern that we see in couples.
Yeah, it's interesting because putting my observations from my practice, you know, my therapy practice, that sort of became the quiz, right? What are the themes I see in the problems people have? And avoidance is huge. And that's actually the subject of the book that I'm releasing in September.
Oh,
it's this whole thing about a sexual avoidance cycle.
Wow.
So what happens is people have sexual experiences that don't meet their expectations, right? They don't seem to go well. And if that happens often enough, right, they start to feel disappointment, inadequacy, you know, anxiety, right? It starts to be this really bad feeling thing. And human nature is to avoid bad feelings, right?
Yes.
So when sex goes badly enough, people start to avoid it, right? And they're avoiding talking about it. They're talking, you know, avoiding having sex, avoiding doing anything about the problem. That, though, creates more pressure. It doesn't make anything go away. It just becomes more pressured because now we're not having sex, or my partner wants to, but I don't, or, you know, and then if you do have sex, there's so much pressure on that encounter to go well, to sort of prove that everything's okay, but it makes it, you know, that much more likely you're going to have trouble again. Mm-hmm. So that becomes this whole cycle, and lots of couples get stuck in this.
It's interesting. You know, in psychology, we have something called escape conditioning or learning, where either a rat or even human beings, that they avoid something as negative, like punishment, and they temporarily feel like a relief, but then they get into a pattern to keep avoiding other things in life that are important, like, you know, talking about relationships or your feelings, and I guess also sexuality. So it can become a very negative pattern. And you said that happens a lot. A lot of couples get into avoiding sex because it's easier to do that, right, than actually confronting the issues. Is that the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think they don't. I think largely they don't know it can get better, right? Because sex seems to be going badly. They don't realize that they either have unrealistic expectations or they're being too hard on themselves as they deal with, you know, common obstacles that come in our sex life. I mean, it's totally normal to struggle with sex, but people don't realize that. So they either think they're broken, their partner's broken, or the relationship is broken. Right? They don't have a way of having hope and realizing, no, wait, these are normal problems, normal struggles. We could work together on this, and there's a way through it.
Yeah, I like the idea of hope, having a positive expectation, because people, they get into a negative downward cycle where, you know, I can't make love properly. My spouse doesn't react to me well. Now, the other thing is another question series, I think, in your quiz talks about the sex end badly, and we're talking about criticizing, blaming, or shaming. So you're talking about sex becoming hostile and angry. What happens when it becomes an angry sex?
Yeah, I mean, by the time you get to a place where partners would be shaming, blaming, and criticizing, right? That's pretty negative. You know, yes. The thing I'm measuring in the quiz at that point is negativity, you know, / hostility.
Yes.
And that's really a relationship issue more than it is a sexual issue, right? People are starting to be mean to each other, basically, treating each other poorly.
So give me an example. Does one couple, one partner said to the other, you know, you don't last as long as my previous partner, or you're not as good, or certain things like that.
Oh, yeah. Or what's wrong with you that you don't want sex, or why won't you do this or that? You know, it's like pathologizing each other and being, you know, super critical and judgy, as opposed to, wait, why would it make sense that you're not really interested in the sex we're having? We need to have a conversation to make sure this works for both of us.
That's interesting. So sex can be used kind of as a tool to punish the other person in some ways, or criticizing them about it. And
certainly. I mean, often I think that comes out of defensiveness, too. Part of the reason I think we blame and criticize is because we feel bad. You know, it's just sort of a defense mechanism.
Definitely.
So
now you talk about a solution. You said stop the bleeding and ask for change. So how does a negative, critical sex life change in this way?
Well, I mean, in the case of couples that have gotten to the place of hostility, they have to start treating each other better, really, before they're going to be able to collaborate on improving their sex life.
Yes.
Right. So some of these people probably need to go to counseling, you know, and get some assistance. But somehow, somebody's got to stop acting this way. You know, we've got to start treating our partner with love and respect, sort of no matter how they're treating us, and try to turn it into more of a virtuous cycle, right, instead of a vicious one.
Yeah, that makes sense. Being gentle and kind can be a foreplay, in a sense, because you build up that rapport, and then eventually in the bedroom it comes out, because there's a...
Yeah. You have to stop a cycle of being cruel to each other before you're going to, you know, you're going to be lovers in any good sense of the word.
Definitely. Another series of questions has to do with fantasy. Are you in your fantasy mind during sex? And you call this absence or distraction. Now, are fantasies useful in sex at all, or should people just be focused in the moment with their partner?
No, fantasies can be useful, and because each thing I'm measuring had sort of, I think, 6 questions for it. So it's not like fantasizing by itself is some really bad sign.
Right.
But it can be a way of escaping what's actually happening with your actual partner, right? So fantasies add sort of mental stimulation to what we're doing, which can be incredibly arousing, right? Mm. Our mind, our brain's the biggest sex organ.
Yes.
But it can take you away from your partner.
Mm.
So it might be better to share the fantasies with your partner. You know, even if you don't act them out, how do you bring them into it and make it, you know, keep you present? But that's only one aspect of being present, you know, being distracted, being worried, you know, about your body or anything else. There's other ways that, you know, keep us from being
so you're on a desert island, and you're finding each other in some beautiful place or something, and share it with your spouse.
Whatever it is. I mean, whatever your eroticism is, your sex is going to get way more interesting if you share some of that with your partner.
Definitely, I can see that. Another thing you talk about in the quiz, and you know, this is really good because you are breaking it down to like characteristics or factors. Lack of desire, and I think you asked them, do you know what turns you on? or how much energy do you put into sex and romance? And apparently there are people that put a lot into it and some don't. And this brings us to a really interesting point, what we call desire discrepancy, or the magic number. Let's say someone wants sex, let's say 7 days a week and some ones once a week. What do you do in those cases when you have a high desire and a low desire person together?
Well, I can tell you this, you don't just average the two numbers.
Oh.
I tell my clients that if we're talking about the frequency, like the number, we're having the wrong conversation. So first people need to know that there's always one person who wants more sex than the other,
yes,
at least over time. Okay. And that can change. It can go back and forth. You can want more than be the higher desire partner in one relationship, the lower desire in another. There's nothing sort of absolute about this. So having a discrepancy is not a problem, but you have to be able to handle that. Okay. And you have to be able to collaborate together. So it's important to figure out, for the person who's less interested in sex, are there any obstacles that we could remove, right? Are there factors that are sort of suppressing what desire they might have?
Yes.
And that could be the type of sex they're having. It could be relationship issues. It could be, you know, things like distraction and overwhelm at work. I mean, there all kinds of things might be going on that could get addressed.
Now, what if you have a high testosterone person with a low testosterone, and maybe it's a genetic or some other like deep-rooted desire for sex or non-desire? Should the couple split up? You know, I've heard this before, where they're totally mismatched in the sexual area, or can they work it out? Do you feel that there is hope in this case, or are some cases difficult?
No, I think mostly there's hope. I tend to think people don't get together unless they sort of overlap enough. But, you know, occasionally the mismatch might be great enough that could be a deal breaker for somebody. But the other thing we need to keep in mind is that one of the people, and often the lower desire partner, might have what I call reactive sexual desire.
Yes.
So certain people have proactive desire. They get horny, they think about sex, they're spontaneously interested, they want to make it happen. And other people have reactive desire, which means they may never think about sex, or almost never, right? Don't feel a spontaneous interest. But if they get going, you know, you start kissing, you start touching, you take whatever time you need, your body starts to respond, you start to get turned on. Mm-hmm. It's like, now I want sex.
Okay, interesting.
Right? That's a valid way of experiencing sexual desire, but both people need to understand that, and they have to be willing to start, right? You have to create the opportunity for that to emerge.
That's a good point.
if you're talking about somebody with, you know, high level of desire and somebody with low, it might just be that they have reactive desire.
That's a good point.
That can totally be accommodated.
Yes. And I think you say it could be male or female. Sometimes the male is the one that has the low desire and the female the high, or vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely. For the people coming into counseling, you know, of my heterosexual couples, I don't know, half the time the woman wants more sex than the guy, you know, and certainly even same-sex couples, somebody wants it more than the other.
And also, you know, I've read a book called Love Types and Guy Types. It talks about compatibility and the personality types. And you also might have different styles of what turns you on. For example, the very sensory people like beautiful environments, sights, and smells. And you know, the intuitives are more into fantasy and role play. So it can also be, you know, tapping into your partner's, say, sexual buttons, or what do you call it, you know, their desires. And the
yes.
way they look at sexuality. And the other thing is that I think you talk about, and this is really interesting, how high desire and low sex desire people have different obstacles. For example, you say that some people try to get validation from sex for their self-esteem.
Yes.
And if they don't get it, they don't feel loved or desired. And that can be a big problem when they tie all their self-esteem into having sex. And if their partner doesn't want to have sex, they feel bad. What do you say to people like that, the high sex desire people?
Yeah, I mean, the people that have the higher desire partner, right, who are really struggling with that, they often take the person's lower desire personally, as if it's about them, right? So
yes.
they are tying their validation to the response they get from their partner, as opposed to thinking, wait, maybe this person doesn't want as much sex. Maybe it has nothing to do with me.
Yes.
Now, sometimes it might have to do with you, and you better take that on, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing something unappealing or something.
Right.
But those people have to start to learn, I don't have to get my validation from other people all the time. How do I feel good enough about myself? And especially, how do I keep advocating for what's important to me without becoming a total nag or a bully? You know, a lot of people in that role will sort of give up initiating.
Yes.
Because it's too painful to get rejected, right?
Right.
So they start
right.
backing off.
Ah.
But that's not going to help the couple address their sex life.
Exactly. And you also say they actually, the high desire partner settles for sex crumbs, like whatever little sex they get just to keep the peace. So what does that mean, sex crumbs?
Well, it's not so much to to keep the peace, it's what I see with couples a lot is the, I mean, this is people that have gotten into therapy, right? So things have gotten bad enough that this is what's happening. So the lower desire person will have sex that they don't really want to have, and they're not very enthusiastic about it, right? Yes. So we're talking about pretty mediocre sex.
Yes.
I mean, really, you'd have to even, some of the time what gets described to me, it's like not even worth having. But the person that with more interest takes that because they're not sure what else they could ever get.
I see where you're
saying. Right? So there's, it's sort of like the person's throwing crumbs on the floor and they're willing to get on the floor and eat them. And this this is not a good dynamic.
Yeah, that sounds very sad in a way. And
it's very sad.
Yeah, it is very sad. And also you said the lower desire partner, they have a lot of power, so they might even take advantage and maybe hurt their partner in some ways. And how do you deal with that part?
Well, they might. They have the control whether they want it or not. Because they're the one that wants something less, they sort of control the spigot, right? They say yes or no or if or how, only because they want it less. So really, this doesn't just apply to sex. This applies to lots of things. A person that wants something less has the control.
Right.
Now, many of the people in that situation don't like that. They don't want that control. But some people start to wield that over each other, right? When things get bad enough, they might enjoy withholding or making the person feel bad. But again, we're talking, this is where people have gotten into a pretty hostile territory.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you say they need to find out how much is sex a priority in their life, the low desire people. And what if it isn't? What if they say, I'd rather watch a ball game or go shopping than sex? And that's what they say to their partner. What do you, how do you counsel people like that?
Well, I mean, that probably is how a lot of them feel. Again, I remind them that their desire might be reactive. And if they made it more of a priority and entered encounters with intention, they might actually end up wanting sex where they wouldn't have thought so, right? So it's not about them having more sex. It's about them wanting more sex. So I try to open that door. But it also is about compassion for your partner. If the lower desire person is just going to sit where they're comfortable and let their partner suffer, I mean, that's just not fair, right? So I point that out. I mean, you're partnered with somebody who is hurting and is longing for something. And you have some obligation, if you're going to be in this relationship, to meet them partway and take this seriously and be an active participant in a sex life that can work for you. Again, it's not just show up and have sex you don't want. It's about how can I want more sex? And if they're really unwilling to do that, it's like, hey, take it or leave it. This is all I got. Mm. You know, the other person has a real decision to make.
Yes. And also, I think in the quiz, you talk about neglect or complacency. Like, do you respond to your partner with ignoring them when they ask for sex or even sarcasm? So what happens, Jessa, if you get to the point of a sexless marriage? Now, I know this could be like a whole topic in itself, where there's just no sex, either for both parties don't want it or, you know, whatever it is, they stay together for the kids or and for other purposes or, you know, legal things. So what do we do in that case? Now, we have maybe the worst case scenario. They've been having a sexless marriage even for years. What do we do now? How can you help people like that? Or is there help?
Well, first of all, if both people don't want it, then there's not a problem. There's no amount of sex that any couple should be having.
Okay.
It's what works for them. So,
so if one wants it and the other one doesn't, I think that's what we're talking about.
Okay, so that's the thing we're really talking about, right? So this is largely, if they're not having sex, they've been in this avoidance cycle. So we need to be talking about what exactly is going on. Why is the person not interested in sex? What are they avoiding? And is that changeable? And I personally believe a lot of times it is. I don't think I could be in this business if I didn't have a lot of hope that people could turn this stuff around.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't necessarily matter how long they've been stuck. I mean, it might feel awkward to start to be physical again after a really long time, but there's ways to make this more comfortable and take sort of, I don't know, baby steps or something, you know, and make it better.
Do you ever have a situation where you say this is not working out for them and they would be better apart in a sexless marriage?
Oh, no. I mean, I would never say that as their therapist.
But do you feel it inside? I mean, is there any situations where, you know, I mean, it could be abuse or other situations where you think they shouldn't be together?
Well, certainly in abuse or, yeah, certainly if there's abuse, something like that, that's a different thing. But I don't see people like that in my practice either. I don't know. Sometimes I guess I don't know that I've had the feeling like, wow, these people just shouldn't be together. But I do sometimes have the response, you know, inside I'm saying, wow, they just are not willing to take the steps. Like something has really got them immobilized, you know?
Right. Yeah. If they're not willing to work on the relationship, they don't want to go to therapy. then what do you say to them?
Well, yeah, I mean, if they don't want to work, they don't want to, I mean, I can't make them, right? All I can do is sort of paint the picture and invite them,
yes.
Invite the horse to water, or is that, lead the horse to water, you can't make them drink?
That's exactly
the phrase, right? So I try to convey hope and explain how they're stuck and explain how common this is, and it totally makes sense, and they're not broken,
right.
And here's the way I see that you can get out of this, and then they've got to decide.
Definitely. Now, one of the interesting things about your materials is you talk about some of the myths about sex, or I guess you can call them challenges also. And one of the big ones, I think you really talk about it, is called unrealistic expectations, whether it's from society, religious, or even pornography, that people have to be perfect in their sex and they have to last a long time and all this kind of stuff. Tell us a little bit about that, the unrealistic expectations, and how it frustrates people.
Well, I think we all build an image of what sex is. Is what we think is supposed to be, right? Sex, relationships, intimacy, you know, from our families, from our society, from pornography, if you've seen any, from movies, from media, from friends, I mean, all kinds of influences sort of give us these ideas, and they're largely unquestioned. But when a couple's in the avoidance cycle, it's all started off because sex has felt disappointing. You know, that sort of by definition means their expectations aren't being met. So we really have to challenge some of these ideas because they're kind of arbitrary. Nothing says, you know, it has to be this way or that way. And there's certainly flat out myths about sex that many people have. They just don't understand how it works. They don't know, for instance, that women, you know, very few women are going to orgasm just from penetration, right? Or they don't know that most men orgasm within 2 minutes of intercourse, you know, in heterosexual sex. So it's like without this knowledge, it's easy to think you're failing, right? If you have this whole other idea in your mind, it's like, what's wrong with us?
How about mutual orgasms? Does that happen often?
No, it happens for some people, but I that's sort of the unicorn, I think, sometimes.
Okay.
I don't think people should lose a lot of sleep if that's not happening. It's fun to try, right?
Yes.
But that takes a lot of stars aligning for many people.
Okay. So then having those expectations of perfect sex makes you, what, frustrated, and then you avoid sex? Is that the idea? Because you're failing?
Yeah. If you have sex that doesn't look like that enough, and you start to feel like something's really wrong.
Right.
You know, and then you get really bad feelings, then why would you do something that makes you feel bad, right? So that's where the avoidance starts to kick in.
I see. And then one thing we talk about here at Love University is one of the great ways to deal with people in love is to love without expectation, and then basically extend your loving energy. You have something similar. You said to have sex without expectation, and you talk about going to an adult playground and just being spontaneous. Tell us about that metaphor, because I kind of like that.
Well, the metaphor is I tell my clients, think about sex like you're going to the playground, which I picked sort of arbitrarily just because it was fun. I don't mean, you know, like childishly, but it's the outing that counts. It's not what you do once you get there. Nothing says you got to go down the slide. You can sit on the bench. Take it a moment at a time. You go with your partner. You share an experience, and that's what matters. So trying to take the pressure off, we have to do X, Y, and Z with this body part, or we have to get to an orgasm, or we have to, you know, none of that really matters. It's about pleasure and connection with your partner.
Yeah, I really like that. Go to the playground, basically have fun and enjoy the process instead of just the result.
Yeah, and I have couples ask me a lot about should we schedule sex, right? This comes up all the time.
Yes.
Like scheduling is a dirty word.
Right.
So no, you don't schedule sex. You schedule a trip to the playground.
Ah.
We're just going to, you know, there's no pressure in that. If we're if we're exhausted, we'll sit on the bench. If we're energetic, if we get going, like we'll stay longer. So schedule intimate time on purpose, but to think of it as there's no expectations is helpful.
So Reggie, my producer, let's go to the playground. Are you ready? I guess it's a sunny day, right? So we can all go to the playground.
Right. So just so we're clear, I don't mean this literally, right? I'm not telling people to go to the playground and have sex.
Okay. That makes sense.
Just as a disclaimer.
Exactly. Now, in terms of, let me give you some commonly held ideas about sex. And you tell me if it's myth or reality, and if so, why?
Okay,
so let's try this.
Okay.
I'll give you a little quiz. Okay. Number one.
Hopefully I'll pass.
I hope so. Number one, sex should be easy. True or false?
No.
No,
I know that's a common belief. Like it shouldn't take, you know, it should just be simple and straightforward and shouldn't take any effort.
It's like in the honeymoon stage, right? When you first got together, you made love every night and it was easy. So shouldn't that be the way it happens?
Nope. Things change. There's just so many reasons it changes. It's a lot to go into, but even the brain chemistry is different in the beginning of a relationship, and we hit obstacles. Things happen in life, right? It's going to take work at some point.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of that is, and this is another like sub idea, is does familiarity reduce sexual desire? For example, if you eat the same plate every day, you might get tired of that hamburger. Is that true, or can you still keep the hamburger very attractive?
Yeah, no, that's true. It's definitely that new relationship thing, the variety, you know, physical attraction, all kinds of things like that I call low-hanging fruit, very easy to respond to.
Yes.
And when you're in a long-term relationship and there's nothing very surprising anymore, and certainly most people have like a way they have sex, absolutely it can get boring. And Esther Perel writes about this really well, I think, that the things that make a relationship secure and stable are the opposite of what make something erotic.
Mm.
So there is definitely a challenge in keeping some zest in your sex life.
So what do we do? Are we all in trouble? We're going to get bored with our sex lives? Or is there a way to spice it up?
I think you have to put some effort into it on purpose, whether it's some novelty, whether it's a you know, almost like different time of day or different room in the house. But one of the biggest things you can do is share eroticism. So like when you were talking about fantasies before,
yes,
we each have something. We each have our own eroticism, the sort of energetics that really turn us on. And that's largely unexplored with people. So if they start to share what really turns them on, you know, what those fantasies are, what the erotic material is that they respond to, if they start to reveal that kind of level about what's arousing to them, sex can get much spicier. And it's not like you have to do this all the time, but, you know, if every once in a while you turned up the heat, that would be good.
Right, but what if they say, well, I'm afraid they'll either laugh at me or they'll reject me. You know, people are afraid to share their desires. So how do you encourage
them?
Yes,
they are.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is a growth point, right? It's really intimate to reveal something that personal. And you've got to be prepared to validate that for yourself. And you've got to, you know, hopefully you go into this with an agreement not to criticize each other, to have, you know, some gentleness around it. But it may not be embraced or shared by your partner, and you're going to have to tolerate that. But that creates closeness and depth in the relationship, too, once you navigate that.
That makes sense. Another one, Jessa, is I don't really need to communicate to my partner. They should know what I want sexually.
No, that's not true either. They don't read minds. Things change. It really is our obligation to share the information about what we want and what we, you know, what turns us on and what doesn't, what's okay, what isn't.
Okay. So do you feel that sex is almost an underlying vehicle for emotional aspects? You know, sometimes people fight over sex, but they're also fighting over other emotional things at the same time.
You can't take sex out of the rest of the relationship, right? It's all entangled.
And then using sex, I guess, as punishment, like I said, the withholding partner, you know, you didn't help me out this way, so I have a headache tonight. How does I have a headache work with your couples?
I mean, you know, the cliche is it's an excuse, right? It's an avoidance tactic,
right,
one of many, for sure. I don't know that it's always meant to be hurtful exactly or like punishing.
Yes.
I think oftentimes people are avoiding for some good reasons and they don't know what to do.
Or maybe they feel hurt. Like,
you
if a partner feels hurt and they don't want to have sex, what do you say in that situation? And the other one wants it. What do you say in that situation? Do you have to work it out?
Well, then you need to be... Yeah, you got to be having those conversations. Like, it's incumbent on the person, I think, to be bringing up what's in their way. So if that includes, I have resentment about how little you help around the house, and it's in my way of wanting to be sexual with you. Like, we need to have that conversation, right? Instead of have it just be all sort of under, I don't know, under the surface.
Right. So communication, I guess, is one big thing that you work with couples, I would imagine. Not just about sex, but in general, and being open with each other and all that. Now, you know, there's a classic technique, and maybe we can talk about any techniques you have, called sensate focusing non-demand, where couples touch each other's bodies, but you know, they don't have genital or intercourse. It's more like getting accustomed to each other. Do you use any techniques like that or any other techniques to help couples that are anxious about sex and performance?
I have my own version of an exercise. It's at this point, I don't know if anybody does it quite like I do. It's highlighted in the book for sure. It's my main tool for couples, actually.
Yes.
So the idea is that the couples take 10-minute turns where one person is a giver and one's a receiver. And the receiver is totally in charge. So the receiver is thinking about what kind of touch would I like most right now, and then they direct the other person.
Yes.
And the giver says no if they need to say no.
Hmm.
So there's no rules about, you know, can't be sexual or has to be sexual. There's no expectations or rules around this. So it gives people a chance to totally think about themselves, put things into words, you know, get in touch with their desires, let themselves receive that if they get it. And it gives the other person the chance, you know, the person that's giving to have boundaries, say no if I need to say no, and and challenge myself if I'm up to that.
That's very interesting. And then they take turns, you said, every 10 minutes they switch off or something?
Yeah. Well, basically it's 20 minutes. So okay. When the alarm goes off, they switch and then that's it. And part of this is have literally no expectations. It doesn't need to be sexual. You're not trying to get carried away.
It may not last 20 minutes, right? If they get really intense.
Well, that's true. They can do whatever they want when the whole thing's over.
Okay. So it's like a discipline, kind of a little bit of structure you're putting into it.
Yes.
And what's the purpose? Are you taking away the anxiety of having to, you know, perform in a certain way? What is the advantage of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to it, actually. I think it's partly practicing something like going to the playground, going into an encounter without any expectations. This is very different from sex. So it's like already we're out of the rut. It's getting people to think about themselves and take care of themselves, which normally people are struggling to do. They're thinking about each other instead, right? And they're exploring without an agenda, so they can learn a lot about what might be pleasing.
And you said the partner that's giving, they can put limits on what they want to do. So how do they do that? They say, I don't want this, or what's the way they respond?
Well, the giver, the instruction is to say no if you need to say no. Yes. So if something's going to be painful or it's really going to be negative, you just say, I need to say no to that, and the person picks something else. But my instruction, if they just want to say no, so this makes me a little anxious, or I don't know if I want to do this, then I invite them to do it anyway, because they're going to learn something about that.
Okay. So it's kind of like a yellow light. They can try it, but they're still kind of looking
at it. Yeah, exactly. Right. It might get worse, and they might need to say no, but you know, they're trying to try, you know, you do your learning outside of your comfort zone. So it's important.
Fascinating. Well, Justin, this has been a wonderful show. I mean, I think we've covered a lot of good material here. And what really made it very interesting to me is that you talk about sex in a sense of an emotional loss or even grief. You talk about it as people that, you know, are suffering from pain, right? If their sex life is not right.
Mm-hmm.
And you said it's very important when it's wrong, but I mean, it's important when it's good too, but a lot more important when it's going bad. And that's...
It feels that way, yes.
Yeah, so this is a really big part of people's lives. So you're dealing with a lot of deep emotional pain issues. Is there anything you've learned in your life that you've applied to this, or do you come from any experiences in life that have helped you become this sex therapist?
Yeah, I mean, a multitude of things. My parents were incredibly happily married for 52 years.
Wow, that's usual sometimes.
And super sex positive and, you know, open and things like that. And yet my marriage failed.
Oh, no.
So that was not enough to equip me for success. So after the divorce is when I went back to school to be a therapist and just sort of really focus on what makes relationships work.
I see what you're saying. Well, Justin, it's been a wonderful time to have you. Now, is there any place where people can go to get your information about your workshops or therapy and things that you do, any website or anything?
Yeah. My website is jessazimmerman.com. And basically, everything's on there, right? My YouTube videos, there's information about the book, the courses, the quiz, all of it's on my website. So that would be the one-stop shopping.
Perfect. You said your book is coming out. Is that a new book, or is that something you're working on?
Yeah. It's a new book. It's coming out September 25th. It's called Sex Without Stress, a couple's guide to overcoming disappointment, avoidance, and pressure. So it's all about this.
Sex without stress. I mean, people don't always put those two together. You think, you know, sex is a stress reliever, supposedly, and has endorphins.
Well, for hopefully it is, but for lots of people, it's stressful.
Interesting. That's pretty fascinating. So definitely, if you ever get down here, we can maybe collaborate on something, if you like, Jezza.
That would be great. Thank you.
We can keep in touch in the future. So this has been Love University. If you have any questions or comments on the show, or if you want to be the guest on the show, you can reach us at lovetype4u, the letter LoveType, 4u at AOL.com. Also, loveuniversity.love. You can call us at 310-226-8090. Again, Jezza, thank you very much for being on the show. And we encourage everyone to practice some of these techniques to have a great sex life, love life, and really develop intimacy, because that's really what makes life worthwhile for many people, is that feeling of being loved and sharing love and accomplishing great things. So for all you students out there, Love University, we're now in recess. Put away your iPads, your pens, your pencils, and your computers, and we'll see you next time.